You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi. The Tillamook County Board of Commissioners voted unanimously for a resolution of no confidence in District Attorney Aubrey Olson. The resolution came after an investigation substantiated 35 claims against Olson and her staff. The most serious claims related to incompetence and lack of care for victims of crimes, especially those involving sexual assault and domestic violence. Before the investigation was complete, Olson attempted to use subpoenas to retaliate against Tillamook County Sheriff Joshua Brown and the whistleblower in the sheriff's office who initiated the investigation. Community members and representatives from Tide of Change, the local agency serving gender-based violence in Tillamook County, appeared at the county commission meeting in support of the no-confidence resolution. In addition to the resolution, county commissioners voted to remove Olson's $20,000 stipend from the county's budget. They also agreed not to pay for Olson's liability insurance against bar claims. Commissioner Aaron Scar said the no-confidence decision was not made lightly, but it was an action the board needed to take. She also noted that Olson refused to work with commissioners to respond to the complaints about her office, and the investigation into the district attorney's office had been necessary. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald, online at tillamookheadlightherald.com.
The suspension of Clatsop Community College's historic preservation program is going ahead even as staff, students, and others ask for the opportunity to reconfigure the program in a way that reduces financial strain on the college. At a recent college board meeting, instructor John Gutenberger made a case for keeping the program, noting it has produced well-paid jobs and resulted in numerous projects relevant to the community. But college president Jared Hoag said the suspension of the historic preservation program, as well as the automotive technology and computer-aided design and drafting programs, were decided based on long-term enrollment, program completion, and graduation rates. The college will not enroll new students into these programs until the administration determines what comes next. Hoag says the college may still offer individual classes or targeted programming in these areas. In an email to The Historian, Hoag said he respected Gutenberger and his contributions to the community, but that the college needs to be honest about the challenges it faces. Earlier this month, the college laid off 5 full-time positions and announced other changes, citing low enrollment and a $700,000 budget deficit. The story comes to us through a news partnership with The Historian. Read more online at dailyhistorian.com.
Changes to Astoria's camping ordinance won't go into effect until July 15th, but work is already underway to prepare people camping on city streets. KMUN's Katie Frankowitz reports.
Earlier this month, Astoria City Councilors passed the amended camping ordinance as part of a new multi-pronged shelter-first policy. The changes spell out an approach to work with people on a case-by-case basis, but also add more serious legal consequences for violating the rules. An estimated 35 people are currently living out of tents set up on city streets in downtown Astoria. But recently, around 7 people moved into shelter as information went out about the new changes to the camping ordinance. That's according to Astoria Police Chief Stacy Kelly, who spoke Wednesday afternoon to a room of residents, business owners, and elected officials during an informal meeting arranged by the Chamber of Commerce.
Don't know if this ordinance is going to solve everything. We'll find out next month, but it definitely looks like we're moving in the right direction.
The week the updated ordinance goes into effect, Kelly says additional officers will be tasked with going out to make sure people follow the rules. Clatsop Community Action's street outreach team has already been going out and connecting with campers, letting them know of the changes coming in mid-July. Kenny Hansen is one half of that team. He says the new camping code is creating an environment where people want to change their lives.
It's given them a reason to actually do it. They're not wanting to be out there generally anyway, and with the changes in the ordinance, it's given them a nudge to go in the right direction.
He said that going into shelter might still be short-term for some of the unhoused campers, but that the new ordinance may also push others to make the extra effort to stay sheltered. I'm Katie Frankowitz reporting.
Designated housing for low-income seniors in Pacific County will remain affordable thanks to a state grant. Earlier this month, the Washington State Department of Commerce announced it awarded $15 million to three multifamily housing projects across the state. That includes nearly $6.5 million to the Joint Pacific Housing Authority to acquire and rehabilitate Raymond House. Raymond House is a 30-unit apartment complex that receives assistance through the United States Department of Agriculture program for elderly and disabled households. Raymond House's mortgage payment was scheduled for later this year, at which point the property would be excised from the USDA program and would transition to market rate rents. Because of the scarcity of available units in Raymond, Joint Pacific County Housing Authority felt it was critical to preserve the affordability of the property. The Housing Authority will focus on preserving and upgrading the building, as well as mechanical and plumbing system upgrades. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. The weather forecast this weekend is looking like a classic Junuary. We are expecting colder temperatures, cloudy skies, and rain. But meteorologists all say signs are pointing to much warmer and drier seasons ahead, and El Niño has taken hold. It's a climate pattern that develops when sea surface temperatures around the equator and the Pacific get warmer than normal. Daniel Hartsock is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Portland, Oregon. He says it's almost no question that this El Niño will continue.
With over a 60% chance that we'll see a very strong El Niño later this fall into the winter time. So that could have impacts across the Pacific Northwest this year.
Some have been calling this the potential for a super El Niño, though that is not an official term. In Washington, that would mean a very strong push toward a warmer, drier winter, in a year that has already brought a statewide drought emergency to Washington for the fourth consecutive year. Across the globe, many forests are popping up using the Miyawaki method. Some say it's a great solution to restore native plant life to urban areas. Others say it has limits. NWPB's Lauren Gallup takes us to Tacoma, where students, professors, and community members are finding ways to make the method work for them.
In the downtown core of industrial Tacoma, surrounded by pavement and concrete, tiny native prairies are sprouting up on the University of Washington Tacoma campus. Michael Dorner, who's a senior here, shows me.
This is a flowering plant known as early blue-eyed Mary.
We crouch down close to where the plants are poking out of the earth.
All of these grasses are actually native prairie grass called Romer's fescue that only grows on the western sides of the Cascades and prairies.
Dorner was one of the people who helped plant the plots of Mini Prairie in October. Already, it seems to be thriving.
Any thoughts on maybe why, too, the prairie is doing particularly well?
In my opinion, I like to think that the prairie wants to come back. I think that it misses Tacoma.
The South Sound area used to be covered in prairie, but most of it has been lost. That's why Dorner and his peers wanted to plant some. It's part of a project to restore native landscapes and increase tree canopy downtown. The group is using the Miyawaki method and other managed landscape practices. That method is a decades-old practice that started in Japan. Part of the method is planting native species close together. There is evidence that that can make plants grow faster. But this native habitat is only a few months old. So to find one that's been around for a little longer, I drove a few minutes away to Tacoma's Hilltop neighborhood. There, one woman has seen how planting a mini forest can make a big difference.
This is definitely a nine bark. Watch out for dog poop too. Oops, sorry, babe. And then that's a snowberry.
Wendy Clapp shows me the native species thriving in her backyard.
The forest, this is one of the most amazing things to me. We planted it, and within the first spring of it being planted, so less than 6 months, our yard was filled with birds.
Since 2024, she's been following the Miyawaki method to plant tree saplings, elderberries, native honeysuckle, and lots of other plants closely together around her yard.
I was really delighted with myself for coming up with a way to incorporate it into sort of a garden plan.
Claflin to make her backyard a forest oasis and a healthier space for her family. For years, she struggled to control an invasive species called Japanese knotweed in her backyard. She wanted to see if filling the yard with dense vegetation would crowd out the weeds. And it is.
This is the first time I've seen real hope, where I see like we're actually making a difference out here now.
There's a lot less knotweed popping up, but there are still some. So to try and get rid of it for good, every fall, Clap applies a herbicide to any new growth. Because the Miyawaki method doesn't allow the use of these chemicals, Clap fences off the surrounding vegetation and applies it with a paintbrush. One of the criticisms of the Miyawaki method is that it is too rigid. That can limit people's ability to use it. Back in downtown, the UW group is making some adaptations to see if this native landscape can be a future oasis in a changing climate. Ruben Casas is a professor at the University of Washington, Tacoma, and one of the leads on this project. In one part of the project, they're doing something called assisted migration. There, they've planted trees from further down along the west coast.
Optimally, we would like to see if the same species but from Oregon or Northern California do well here.
The idea is to take trees or other plants and move them to where they might be more successful with climate change.
As temperatures increase, as winters become drier, that could become instructive for what we end up planting 10 or 15 years from now in other parts of Tacoma or Western Washington.
The group hopes that a green space like this could still thrive as the climate changes. In Tacoma, I'm Lauren Gallup.
Some school districts in Washington will have to pay an average of 45% more in risk coverage. As KUOW's Noelle Gasco reports, their rate increases are a result of payouts tied to sex abuse cases.
In 2019, the state legislature changed its statute of limitation laws for sexual abuse. Deborah Callahan is the CEO of the Washington Schools Risk Management Pool, which provides risk coverage to about 130 districts. She says since then, there have been new abuse claims dating back four decades.
It's our districts that have to use money that they receive from the state that would normally be going into the classrooms for kiddos that they have to send to us now because the cost of these claims are going up.
The amount a district could be paying into the pool varies, according to Callahan, but a large district could now have to pay millions. I'm Noelle Gasca in Seattle.
Activists with the Center for Biological Diversity have sued the Trump administration to protect one of the West Coast's apex predators. It's a sea star with two dozen arms called the Sunflower Star. KUOW's John Ryan reports.
A widespread outbreak of a wasting disease killed around 5 billion sunflower stars over the past decade, from Alaska to Mexico. Jason Hoden researches sunflower stars for the University of Washington in Friday Harbor.
We have about 10% of the stars left that we used to have from this species.
International scientists and the government of Canada have declared the species endangered. The Biden administration proposed protecting sunflower stars under the Endangered Species Act. The lawsuit aims to force the government to provide that protection. No creatures have been added to the endangered species list since Donald Trump took office. Sunflower stars play a major role in keeping coastal habitats productive. By preying on little grazing animals like sea urchins, the stars protect kelp forests from overgrazing. I'm John Ryan reporting.
A judge has extended the deadline to take down the fence at the Eugene Federal Building to July 2nd. KLCC's Nathan Wilk reports.
On Monday, federal judge Mustafa Kasubai sided with local activists suing the federal government over the fence. He issued a preliminary injunction citing free speech concerns and gave the government 48 hours to remove the barrier. But in a filing Tuesday evening, the government said this timeline was impossible and asked for until July 5th instead. They said it could take 11 days to coordinate a traffic control plan with the city and get a contractor to do the job. On Wednesday, Kasubai instead gave the government until 7 a.m. on July 2nd. If they don't meet that deadline, they could be held in contempt of court. The plaintiff's lawyers praised the court Wednesday for emphasizing First Amendment rights. This is Nathan Wilk reporting.
Portland Trailblazers owner Tom Dundon told state and city leaders yesterday he's done a lot to help the city by buying the team. Dundon did not seem interested in putting up more money for Moda Center renovations. Kyra Buckley reports.
Dundon and his team want around $600 million to renovate the 30-year-old Moda Center. The Blazers owner spoke to a crowd of more than 750 business and political leaders at the Portland Metro Chamber's annual meeting. He says the Blazers already pay a premium to operate in Portland compared to other cities, and in return, the public could pay for the arena fixes.
It feels like we're making a pretty big investment by staying here and paying these tax rates and agreeing to these fees for dollars that go back into the building.
The state has committed more than half of the proposed funds. Portland City Council has until mid-August to hammer out if it will contribute and how much. I'm Kyra Buckley reporting.
A Lutheran church in Portland plans to return its land to an indigenous organization. Church leaders say they're giving back stolen land. As Joni Auden-Land reports, it's part of a growing movement.
After Bethany Lutheran Church closed in 2024, leaders from the Oregon Synod thought about what to do next. They could sell the building. They could repurpose it. Ultimately, they decided to give, or as they say, return the land to the Native American Youth and Family Center, or NAYA. Bishop Lori Larson Caesar says it's a small step toward repairing centuries of damage. She says churches often stole land from indigenous tribes in the name of religion.
It felt like returning something stolen was the best thing we could possibly do.
It's part of a growing trend. Churches across the country are donating their land to different tribes and organizations. NAYA plans to turn the building into affordable housing for indigenous elders.
That was Joni Auden-Land reporting. You're listening to KMUN.
Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. There's another development in the deployment of the expanded and notoriously inaccurate SAVE database, repurposed to verify citizenship for voting purposes. The Trump administration, having lost multiple court challenges, is reportedly proposing to withhold state election security funding for noncompliance. In 2025, the Trump Justice Department asked, then demanded, that states submit voter rolls and other personal information, hoping to identify exceedingly rare non-citizen voters. DOJ then sued 30 states for not complying. According to a Brennan Center tracker, judges dismissed cases against 9 of those states. June 22nd, a federal district judge in D.C. blocked inclusion of Social Security and other federal data as a violation of federal privacy statutes. Having lost in court, the Trump administration is apparently ramping up pressure using the power of the purse. CNN reported June 23rd that it obtained a draft memo suggesting that the Department of Homeland Security will threaten the withholding of 20% of state CISA election security funding if states don't comply with the SAVE database demands and implement other election administration changes. Since 2018, CISA grants helped states harden their election systems from foreign attackers, including Russia, China, and Iran. We've linked to CNN's reporting at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
You're listening to KMUN.